Yeah, time. Hello.
Good afternoon. Oh, come on. Good afternoon. How's everybody doing? Good so far? Surviving the 100-degree weather outside? Cool. So thank you, everyone, for coming to our troubleshooting session today. I was a little worried when I walked in and saw the size of the room that it would be sort of like a canyon, but nice to see that we've got a lot of you here in our session. So quick introductions, and then we'll get right into the session. My name is Scott Stubberfield. I'm on the Link customer engineering team in our product engineering group. I've been at Microsoft about 9 years, most recently in the product engineering group for a year and a half, almost 2 years. And I have an assistant with me today whose name is not on the slide, but Aaron's going to help out with the session as well, and I'll allow him to introduce himself now.
Sure, Aaron Miller. I'm on the same team with Scott here, customer engineering. Been in Microsoft a little over 4 years. Been with this team, however, about just over half a year, I think. Coming up on a year, maybe, somewhere in there. Previous to that was consulting with Microsoft, doing the Link deployments, mostly in the federal sector. So,
cool. So I am Canadian, so every once in a while there are a few things that I'll say that might sound a little weird, like a boot. Do I have any other Canadians in the audience with me today? One guy. Two. One. Wicked. Three.
That's a high percentage.
It's a high percentage. Sometimes it's like none, so thankfully there's someone else. So if I say anything that's not quite on, then it's maybe because I'm Canadian. Anyways, we'll get into it. Okay, so what are our goals for today's session? So we wanted to share with you our experience in developing, you know, in kind of the work that Aaron and I have done over the year in various programs that we've been involved in around troubleshooting. So we'll talk about what some applicable troubleshooting tools are that you can use on Link. They're pretty basic. There's a couple of them that I would recommend you use. And then we'll talk about developing a systematic approach to using those troubleshooting tools. And what we're going to walk you through today is not to say this is the only way to troubleshoot a problem. What we want to walk you through is our systematic way of troubleshooting a problem so that you can use that, leverage that, and develop your own method. So rather than going into server and start changing things on the network and making configuration changes when you don't even know what the root cause of a problem is, we want to try and help you to get to the root cause of the problem. So we'll look at the tools, we'll discuss a systematic approach, and then a lot of the session is essentially going to be a live demo. I've taken my lab environment and I've configured a number of breaks in that lab environment. And Aaron here is going to walk through trying to fix all of those breaks. He knows a little bit of background of the environment. I've just kind of given him a heads up of some where the clients are and some of the basics of the Link environment, but he does not know the specifics of the breaks. So we'll see how well he does, and if he doesn't do very well, I'll fire him and never use him again in my session. I'm kidding. I would never do that. Okay, so the first tool that we're going to talk about is Snooper. And I hope the fact that you're here to talk about Link troubleshooting, that you've already seen the Snooper tool, and that this shouldn't come as a big surprise to you. And I call this the tool, right? So pretty much any troubleshooting that you can do in Link, either on the client side or on the server side, would revolve around the use of the Snooper tool, right? There are a number of different messages that appear in the Snooper tool. SIP messages, service messages, all that kind of stuff will appear in the messages pane in Snooper, but there's other data in there as well that Snooper will parse and show you in the other tab that you can see here on the left-hand side, the trace tab. So really, Snooper is your friend. And in Link 2013, we kind of changed a little bit about how this tool was released. It used to be released as part of the resource kit, but now we've released it as part of what we call the debugging tools. Okay? I'm not going to go into it that much and open it up and kind of walk you through and show you a demo of all the different features that are in it, but when we get to the troubleshooting section, the live demo part, we will go into Snooper, we'll open it up, and we'll talk about how you can search and how you can, you know, trace different calls and connect different calls together. So we will get into a demo piece of that. And again, the important thing to remember is that Snooper is your tool to read not only server-side log files, but client-side log files as well. And then the second tool that I wanted to touch on in this session is the centralized logging service. And this was something that we released in Link 2013, and it's new in Link 2013. So why did we release the centralized logging service? Let's say that in Link 2010, you had a pool of servers. You had 8 front-end servers. And you had an issue. A user couldn't place a call. A user couldn't register. They couldn't sign in. They were getting some sort of invalid policy on sign-in. What did you have to do to collect trace files using the what used to be the OCS component logger tool? Exactly. So I had to have 8 windows open, and I had to open up the component logging tool, set it all up the way that I wanted to across 8 servers, and then I'd get my test machine ready, and I'd say to my user, okay, ready? Hold on. Open up my 8 machines and click start 8 times across the board. And then I'd say, okay, replicate the problem. And then I'd come back and I'd go stop across the board 8 times. And then I had to go back to each individual server, convert all the trace files, open each one in Snooper, and dig across 8 servers and hopefully find the problem where I was at. Not very efficient, right? Really, really, really not very efficient. So in a lab environment, like we're going to show you later today, when I've maybe only got 1 or 2 servers in play, not a big deal. I can do that in my lab. In a real customer environment where you have a large infrastructure, you couldn't do this. Hence, we released the centralized logging service. Okay? So it allows the IT admin to manage logs from a central location in terms of not only what logs we want to collect, but what servers we want to target to collect those logs on. And then even better than that, the ability to search within those log files and produce output that I can view in one centralized spot. So I don't have to go back to all these different servers in my environment. And these are all based on scenarios, and we'll get to the slide later that shows kind of what the scenarios are. And again, it's based on pool, it's based on server. I have a lot of different flexibility as to how I start and stop the centralized logging service. This is kind of what the architecture looks like. So we have this thing in the middle called the CLS controller. And the CLS controller really reaches out to the CLS agent on each front-end server, tells it when to start collecting log files, when to stop collecting log files, and more importantly, what it should actually collect. Okay, so think back to my example of how we did this in previous releases of the product. You set it all up, you press start across the board, you did your repro, you press stop across the board. CLS manages that for you now. The really nice part is it's all based on PowerShell commandlets. Okay, and a couple of slides will show what those PowerShell commandlets are. So here are the various scenarios, and these are scenarios that are created for you out of the box, right? These are scenarios that we felt were sort of popular scenarios that has the right components and the right level of logging that we felt that out of the box was a good start to get you going, okay? And again, I'm not going to read through each one of them. I'm not going to describe every one of them. I think you guys can look at them and kind of get a general understanding of what each of them does. But if you wanted to dig deeper into a scenario and get a little bit more information, you can run the PowerShell snippet that's on the left-hand side. Get-CSCLS scenario, and I choose global and then the scenario name. So in this example, we've done this for the incoming and outgoing call scenario. And then we pipe that to this option that we call select-expand property, and we expand the provider field, and then we pipe that to a formatted table. And then you would get an output that looks like what's on the right-hand side of that screen. And that tells you that for the incoming and outgoing call scenario, it shows you all of the components that we're logging, it shows you the level, and it shows you the various flags. Make sense so far? Okay. So in addition to those scenarios that have specific components, we also have this, wow, that light just got really bright. Wicked. Now I can't see anybody in the middle of this, in the middle of the room here. So we have this additional scenario called the always-on scenario. And what's nice about the always-on scenario is, guess what? It's always on, right? So I don't have to go back after the fact that when I've had a problem and turn on logging and do a repro and try and catch it. It's a scenario that's always there. It's always running. It's always collecting logs. Now, the downside to the always-on scenario is that it's only collecting the info level for all of the components that it's tracing. And in some cases, info might not be enough to actually figure out and debug the problem that you have. But what I like about always on is if you have it running, you can go back in, search it, figure out the component that you're concerned with, and maybe there's enough information in there to at least give you a sense of what was going on, and then you can go back and go, oh, now I know what I want to log for a little deeper, a deeper level. I'm going to go back and create maybe a new custom scenario and turn on logging for that, or go back and run one of the out-of-the-box scenarios. The one thing to remember about the always-on scenario is that any given time, you can be running always on and one custom scenario. Okay? So you can't run two custom scenarios at the same time, but you can run always on with another custom scenario. So if always on or the out of the box scenarios are not enough for you, you can actually go ahead and create your own new custom scenario. And this PowerShell commandlets here that I've given you on the screen show how we can go ahead and create a new custom scenario. So I've given you an example. I've called it custom verbose 3 because I didn't like custom verbose 1 and number 2. They weren't good enough for me. So I've taken and added SIPStack, outbound routing, and S4 into this custom scenario. And you also see there that I've created the level, I've set the level to verbose because I wanted to create a custom scenario that looked at all these components and captured them at the verbose level. Okay? So if you want to take an out-of-the-box scenario and make it a verbose scenario, you have to create a custom scenario. You can't just say do out-of-the-box, but do it at a verbose level. Okay? The one note on the bottom there, there's two important notes in the bottom there. One, it might take a short period of time for the custom scenario that you've created to be available for the CLS service. Why is this? Because when you create the custom scenario, it gets created in your topology file on the back end that hosts the topology document. That topology file then gets replicated, right, through the normal topology replication process around to all your front ends. And then the CLS service needs to go and read that it has that new custom scenario. So if you just go ahead and create a new custom scenario and try and start it right away, it will not be available to you. So wait 2-3 minutes, try and start it, and it should be there. There's also a known bug in the CLS service. And it's really important that you guys catch this one. So at the bottom of the screen, I said, if you specify all in the log level, it's actually ironic because you get nothing when you try and grab these logs. Okay, so we have a bug in the CLS service that if you set the level to all, we actually don't grab any logs. And this really might frustrate you if you're trying to do this in your lab, because it did me. So I'm suggesting that you use the level of verbose or the level of debug, but do not use the level of all right now because it is still broken, to my knowledge. I don't believe that we fixed this yet. Okay, so here's some examples of how you would go ahead and use the CLS logging service. So the first one shows us how we would start CLS logging using the scenario always on. So if I do start-cs-clslogging, scenario always on, always on will be running, and then I can just leave it. I don't have to worry about it. I don't ever have to stop it if I don't want to. It's just always logging. And it will roll over log files based on how you've configured the CLS service, right? So it's not going to shut down your front-end servers because it consumes all the disk space. You'll specify a maximum for how big the log file should get to. When it gets to that point, it'll stop logging. We've got an example there of how to start CLS logging. For one of the scenarios called incoming and outgoing call. And you'll see in that example, I've specified the pool. So if I had multiple pools in my environment, that would just target to start CLS logging on just that pool. If I left out the pools flag, it would actually go into my topology document, figure out all the pools that I have in my environment, and start that scenario on each front-end server in that environment. And not just front-end servers, mediation servers, edge servers. It would go out and look at every server in the topology that's CLS aware, and it would go ahead and start it. And then the last one there is how we go ahead and stop CLS logging. Okay, so once that's done, so we start a scenario, we do something, we collect log files, we stop a scenario. Then we actually use search-cslslogging, and that actually goes into the log files that we've just gathered and searches for the various components that I specified, including pools, including component, and then spits that out to a log file that I can then open in Snooper. So what's really nice about this one is I can start scenarios for 7 different components, but then when I go and do my search, I can search for specific components. So maybe I'm going to start with the SIPStack component, and I gather what's in the SIPStack, I read that out, I look, and I go, oh, you know what, maybe I really need the S4, or I need mediation, or something else. I can then just go back and research again, adding that different component in. I don't need to go back and collect all the log data again, because all that log data is there, I'm just gonna search against it. Same thing with the pools, right? So I can start with, maybe I know specifically which pool the user was registered to, or even which front-end server, and I kinda wanna reduce the amount of output that I get from the search. I can target it at a specific computer or pool, create my output, do my search, look at it, go, oh, it's not enough. I can then research. Another really important thing here. In this example, I've specified dash log level verbose. Okay? So if you go and you collect log files at the verbose level, but you don't specify that level when searching, search only searches for info and lower. It does not search up to the verbose level. Okay? So if you've collected data at the verbose level, you need to search for data against the verbose level. Otherwise, you don't get anything. Also, potentially really frustrating to you if you're working on this in a lab and you didn't know that. Not that I would ever have done that. Okay? So what this does is this creates a log file output based on the name that you specified, and then you can go ahead and open that up in Snooper. Make sense so far? Okay, cool. So a couple more slides, and then we'll actually get into a live demo. So the reason that I'm showing you this screenshot is not because you ever need to go in and mess around with these log files, but I have had people ask me in the past, hey, you know, where is this data stored? I want to go figure out if I'm consuming too much data. I want to see how big it is. So that's where the data is stored. See Windows, Service Profiles, Network Service, App Data, Local, Temp, Tracing. If you look at the CLS configuration in PowerShell, it will tell you it's in percent temp percent. Well, if you're logged into your server as admin1 and you type percent temp percent, you won't find these log files because link runs is the network service. So you actually need to go into percent temp percent for the network service, which is the path that's shown in this screenshot. Okay? So the cache file in here is actually the log data that's captured, and this HDR file is essentially a header file that I've shown an example of here. And it shows you the time that the agent started, the time that the agent stopped, it shows you the level that it captured, and it shows you all the components that it captured for as well. Again, you really shouldn't ever need to go in there and mess around with those files. Excuse me, you shouldn't need to delete them manually. They will delete themselves as needed, but it's there more as a reference for you. Okay, so a couple other references for you. Obviously, I've given you the whole link to TechNet on the CLS service. You know, I probably could have done an entire session on CLS service and CLS logging. I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to introduce it to you guys, give you some background, and if it's a tool that you haven't played with in your lab, give you kind of the base understanding of the components. Go in, check it out in your lab, and really kind of learn it so that when you're in a customer situation and you've got an outage, you got that in your back pocket and you're ready to pull it out. And you say, hey, I can save the day because I know how to run the CLS logging service in my environment. So there's a couple of blog posts there as well. One of them is the CLS deep dive, and then there's also one from Jens on using the CLS logging service. Okay, so that's kind of the background on the tools. Now we want to get into an actual problem identification and resolution. So this is where Aaron's going to show off a little bit. So here's our fictitious support incident. So users reported that they're unable to call a coworker. The coworker uses a PBX phone located here in the middle of the screen and can be reached at 1-425-555-1002. The user out here, which is our user that's reported the incident running on an external client, typically would dial 1002, and the call would complete. However, today that's not working. That's the extent of what we have on our support ticket. Pretty standard stuff, right? For anyone who helps support Link in their environment, not a lot of detail, not a lot of information, pretty generic problem. I used to dial 4 digits and make a PBX phone ring. That's not working today, please help. Okay, the support ticket indicated that the person was working from home. So what are we going to do? We're going to perform investigations using relevant log files, systematic troubleshooting techniques, isolate the problems one at a time, and fix them in a kind of logical manner. Okay? So background on the environment. It's my lab. It's my home lab. Okay? There is no internet access in my home lab. So I don't have a client on the internet and an edge server published on the internet, but they're quasi on the internet. Right? So my lab has an internal network, and it has an external network. My external client is on my external network and typically would be connected to an edge server that's also in that external network. So I don't know, maybe this is lost on the non-Americans in the room, but in America there's this company called Staples, right? And one of their things is press the I believe button. It's a big red button. So today we're going to do a little bit of pressing the I believe button. I haven't done any tricks in my lab to make stuff not work. There's services and things that are misconfigurations that are broken. And now we're going to try and walk through fixing those. So you want to switch over to 8? Okay, so we've switched over to our lab environment. Player 4 is the user that you can see on the screen right now. They are the person that is trying to dial 1002. It is a PBX phone that's running on the host computer. The goal of this at the end is to make that PBX phone ring. Okay? Make sense so far? All right. So, Mr. Miller, where would you start?
All right. So, obviously, we've had one user report. The assumption is if there were lots of users reporting, I probably would approach this differently because there's different symptoms, right? But with one user reporting, luckily, we're in a situation where we have the ability to remote view this remote user. So,
would you go in and just start making server changes at this point?
No.
Probably not a great idea, right?
I wouldn't even go look at it. I'd assume everything was happy and healthy, and the user doesn't know how to use the proper interface, or that they maybe haven't even plugged in their computer.
Okay, cool. And one thing to keep in mind that some of the breaks that I put in my environment, I had to do in a certain way just because of what I can control in my environment. I would assume that if you're probably properly monitoring your link environment, that some of the stuff you're going to run into here, you may not actually need to go through the process that we're doing, but we wanted to kind of walk through this process just so that you can kind of see how it would work.
Great.
Okay, so Aaron's gone ahead and clicked sign in on that user.
Right, so I see that the user is basically stalled in their sign-in process or in a continuous loop. And just so you guys know, he clicked the sign-in button before the session even started, so it's still been signing in that whole time. So there's this fun new feature that's been added in 2013 called sign-in logs, which is somewhat informative, something that we can take a peek just to kind of get an idea of where we're at in the process here, see what's going on.
And how did you get to that, Aaron?
Again, this is in the taskbar down here. If you hold control and right click, as those of you remember configuration information, that's how you used to get to that. There's a new feature, new option called sign in logs. So we go to sign in logs.
And again, that was introduced, I think, in CU2, CU3, something like that.
I thought it was 4, but yeah, somewhere after there. Yeah.
Basically any of
not RTM.
Yeah, the latest release of the client, if you have that deployed, you would have this sign-in logs option. If you're not running the latest release of the client, you wouldn't have it.
So there's some information in here. It's a little harder for me to read, so I'm going to pull it out into a notepad here. Click copy clipboard. There's my notepad. So I see I do have a failed log on here, and he's giving me some information. He's been retrying this whole time. Okay, so why am I failing log on? He's talking about SIP internal, other passes and fails.
Can you zoom it? Can you
control
one then?
Is that not looking good? There we go.
There we go.
That's probably better.
So what is the first thing that you guys see there? Under login fail, what do you see? Server returned. Pardon? Access denied? Okay. Where do you guys think that server name came from? Pardon? Auto discover, do you think? Because it doesn't say anything about auto discover, it just says. Sorry, I can't hear you. It's a local lookup, but do you think based on seeing this that we actually did any lookup? So where does it pull that server name from, that SIP L15.p52? Where do you think it pulled that from? Endpoint configuration cache. Thank you very much. Okay, so the endpoint configuration cache stores the last known good server that client signed into. Okay, so if my client had signed into that server and it had connected, we would write that value into the endpoint configuration cache. Go ahead.
So I also see some other references in here. One thing I would probably check is, yes, there's the endpoint configuration cache, but I always like to make sure that we haven't stored something manually in here with the automatic config and manual before I go validate that we're actually doing our lookups properly. So after this point, obviously they're having trouble getting to the system, basically timing out and trying to get to our external system. So I would probably try to verify that they have any access. Of course, that's somewhat misnomer because I'm remoted in, but maybe there's some strange internet connectivity issue for this user. So I'm going to go ahead and verify that. In the lab, I asked this earlier just to make sure I had a way to show it. We can't hit Bing or other possible search engines that are well known. So we're going to just hit dial in because that's a nice constant for most link deployments or whatever your well-known simple URIs may be, just to make sure that I'm getting somewhere. Okay, so I'm showing that I can get out of my client. I can get somewhere, we'll call it the internet. In this case, reverse proxy, whatnot. My client is working, so I know connectivity is good. So then my next question is, can I even find the edge servers to sign in? So let's get us
wrong one.
Sorry, shortcuts. I'll stop blowing in the mic, apologies. All right, so let's take a look, some NS lookup time.
And so what is our assumption right now that is the server that we should be connecting to based on what we saw in the client logs?
So in the client logs, I saw that it wanted to connect to its home server, but since it's external, that's invalid, that being the endpoint cache, it wouldn't be able to get there. So it should be trying to find and connect to the edge server. And there's a process pretty well documented for that. Luckily, I'm a seasoned administrator, and I know that process off the top of my head. Otherwise, quick search will find it for me. So I say, let's look up link discover.
And would link discover be used if I was using link 2010 clients?
No.
So this would be a link 2013 thing only, that the link 2013 thick client uses link discover.
Yeah, link 2013 any clients, really, the mobiles or actual full client, gets us to using link discover, but that being its first choice, and of course, internal versus external and all that good stuff, but I'll spare you those because we know we're external. So if that's not configured, then we say there's obviously no DNS entry for it, or I'm having a DNS issue.
So as your link architect, I told you that we didn't architect for link discover to be available externally.
Got it.
Should have probably told you that before, right?
Maybe. Or as a somebody who's been working in the environment, maybe I should have known before, but maybe I just hoped we had updated.
No, you're brought in to help me fix my, save my job. So don't get me fired.
Got it. All right, so then I know the well-known service record here. So we're going to go, if I can stop being dyslexic for a moment.
You need to type type equals SRV first.
I do, you're right. Change my mode here in NS lookup. Oh, this keyboard. SRV will be good. I like all personally, but.
So I probably should have plugged in Aaron's keyboard and laptop up there, but just to keep my
Is this in like the Canadian config here?
Yeah, exactly.
It's giving me problems.
Right, so in NS lookup, we've gone into SRV mode, right? So we're saying we want to look up for this SRV record. We want to look up and see what the host name is that's returned.
P52.ca.
Correct. Yeah. Zoom it, Control 1.
All right, so I do get a result for that, and the result is sipl15.p52ca, which was the same as my server name, right?
Yeah.
With an IP address. I'm not certain if that's the proper IP address or not, because I don't know this environment, so let me see what I can figure out. So I know I should be able to find my edge server because I have a service record. So can I get to SIPL15, which I thought was an internal server, but let's find out. I can. All right.
Via ping.
So my next step would be to see, can I get there? Am I being blocked for my ports in any way? So normally I'd be hitting port 443 for my sign-in process on the edge servers. And My favorite way of checking that is Telnet, but I've been burned by that in the past, just because we don't like to install it anymore for some reason on our OSs. It's there, you can install it, it doesn't require a reboot, but it's not always there by default, unless you have awesome desktop guys who built the image with it in there because they love you. So Telnetting, I'm hoping he has it installed here. 68, 152, 210 to 443. Oh, fail hard. The other reason I'm cautious about Telnet is, again, not being fully aware of the architecture. If they happen to use hardware load balancers, I might get a false positive here. If I had connected, I could be hitting the hardware load balancer and it opening that port for me, but the servers behind it might not be responding. So I try to use Telnet now with a little grain of salt. From the server side or the admin side, great tool, but when you're using it from a client's point of view, you kind of have to think through the flow of the traffic and make sure you're getting the results you really wanted.
So Aaron, at this point, before we go one step further, if we were to look at the log file that was being generated by that link client, would you actually expect to see any SIP traffic to anything based on what you've now discovered?
No, I think I would see it timing out trying to get to the servers, which would pretty much show me not much.
Okay. So can we just show that? Can you go ahead and hit cancel
on
the...
If I can not pop up other things. Where did it go? Not that one, right here.
There's a lot of windows.
I don't know what this one is. Yeah, I must have switched.
Hold on.
Ah, something in that one. Got it.
Yeah.
All righty. So.
Hey, look at that, the tracing folder.
Just happened to be open.
So I don't know if we could have made that any more complicated. Right? We kind of tried to bury the tracing folder. I don't know why we did that.
I think we've been trying to make it more complicated, actually, as we rev. But
yeah.
It was easier in the previous versions.
Yeah, exactly. So it's in your user store, app data, local, Microsoft Office 15.0/link/tracing. Good luck finding it.
Okay, so luckily, Snooper is associated with this already, so I'll just double-click this guy and shortcut us here. And the good old trace or messages.
Let's go all the way down to the bottom, right?
Yeah, this has a whole lot of information in it already. So I'm not sure what's relevant and what's not in here because I don't know the timing too much of when the failure started, when they started acting. So I'm just going to get a clean log real quick.
So what would be one good thing to do before you clean those logs? Maybe save off what's there? In case you wanted to go back retroactively once you learned something?
Yeah, it would. That would probably be a good practice. Where I usually try to decide that is depending on if I've recreated it and I'm getting different experiences. If it's my first time looking at it, probably definitely keep that around just in case the next time I test it, it happens to work. That way I can pull back those logs to make sure. But before I clear them, I tend to make a clean break of those logs. I'm just going to call this fail one or file one. That's good
enough.
There we go.
Now, what time zone are the client logs stored in? Anyone know? If I'm looking at a client log and I see time there, what time is that? Pardon? UTC? Not correct. On a client log. The client logs are stored in the local time zone of the client's workstation. Okay, really important to remember that difference. So you actually see, I know it's probably kind of hard, but my laptop desktop is on the outside. It's 1:49 central time here right now in Houston. My lab machines are all in the eastern time zone because that's where I live. So typically I work everything in eastern time zone. So you really do need to kind of keep on your toes in terms of, am I looking at a client log file or a server log file? And where was that client log file captured? So because those client log files were captured in the Eastern time zone, that's the time that would appear. When we look at a server-side log file, those log files are captured in GMT. So again, if you're trying to compare side-by-side between client and server, you need to make sure that you're accounting for those time differences and don't get thrown off by that.
yeah, it can get confusing, certainly. Even more so when you do the server side and you're dealing with different regions and you're trying to do cross-server stuff and they're in different time zones. It's where UTC on the server side is helpful.
Okay, so what Aaron's done is he's gone in, he exited out a link so that we could completely clear the log files, and he's gone and he's gone ahead and hit sign in again.
And we're not going to wait for it to completely fail, because while it would eat a lot of good time for us, it's going to take a while. So I'm going to go ahead and cancel it and just see what progress we had in the meantime.
Now, does anyone think that there should be SIP messages in this log file right now, based on what we've seen? So Aaron tried to telnet to port 443, and it said connection refused. Should there be a SIP message? No. There shouldn't be.
Let's find out.
And look at that, no SIP messages, okay? And I realize that maybe I'm being a little slow in how we kind of walk through this, and you're probably sitting in the room going, well, I know what the problem is, let's just let me go fix it, right? But we're really trying to kind of walk through this in detail so that you guys can sort of think through these things. So the fact that Aaron tried to telnet to port 443 and it was refused should tell me that I don't have any SIP messages in my log file. If I've cleared my log file and I do have SIP messages, then that tells me that there's another problem in my environment. Maybe I've got a manual configuration server set, which you had kind of checked for.
Right.
Okay?
Or something further in the line. I can get to that port, but I can't get past it.
Yeah, exactly.
So there are other fun informations that you can find under tracing. They'll tell you some of the details that we saw earlier in the connection log and the sign-in log that was talking about which DNS entries it attempted and things like that. It's a little harder to read. It breaks things up into multiple pieces, so it's not as easy as to look at as the SIP messages. I have found it valuable at times in the past, but we're already on a track here. At this point, this would probably be a distraction. We've already done a telnet. We have an idea that there's a connection problem to the server.
But if you needed to go in for more detail and weren't quite sure, this trace tab in Snooper would be where you would want.
Yes, and I'm a huge fan of the searching. Obviously, fail is always marked in red, but you could definitely search for things. If I wanted to see where it's referencing port 443 or something, I can filter that down pretty quickly in there. It's very useful. In fact, the tracing is, in my opinion, not as useful unless you've filtered it in some way, because otherwise, you're just looking through a lot of random entries that most of the time don't have much context to be
needle
helpful.
Needle in a haystack stuff,
yes,
right?
Very.
Okay. So. Cool. So you've telnetted to 443, and it's down. You've checked that we have internet access to other hosts that are in that same network segment. Now what would be your next step that you would want to try?
I would want to know why 443 wasn't responding. So assuming that I'm there as the hero to save the day for the admin, I would say, get me on your Edge server. So I see over here we have two Edge servers.
L15.
The L15. Yep. There it is, yeah. Sorry, good call. Ah, we're versioning. All right, so here we are. We're in a console. So there are many ways to do this. You can PowerShell it. I'm still somewhat lazy and like to use my GUI from time to time. So, oops, again with the not in the right window. Sorry, you get in habits from your own labs, right?
Yeah,
like
I know.
The way you interface with stuff.
So what are you looking for?
Services.
Okay.
So quick check. It's the lazy admin way to find out what's going on, but are my services running? I see that I have two services not running. One is actually disabled. So that obviously is going to cause me a problem. And just to prove the point, this one being the access service, that would be the service that I actually failed to connect to. So
again, I'm pretty sure there's probably a lot of you in the room going, hey, dude, check if the Edge server is running, right? Just for illustration's sake, I wanted us to kind of walk through all of the various things. I mean, there could have been any multitude of reasons why that client that we were looking at couldn't access the Edge server on port 443. But if I had sort of allowed Aaron to go here and check it right away, it would have been sort of very obvious.
Well,
what the
and another point, I mean, obviously it's a contrived situation, but right now I only have one report of an issue, so my thought wouldn't have been that the service has a problem, because I would expect multiple reports simultaneously, the slew of people complaining and the boss coming, hey, nobody can get on.
Right.
So and in reality,
if this service was down, you probably would have had a lot of calls.
Right. Or half of them, as you know, maybe there's two and one's down and the other's up and weird things like that. So so we'll go ahead and fire this guy back up.
We probably should fix that other problem you noticed too, right?
Yeah, and I'm debating whether that makes us go too fast, but I'll go ahead and be a proactive administrator here and not wait for this to cause me another problem. I'll assume, you know, IT security or somebody decided that that service was unnecessary and set it to be disabled. And go ahead and get all my link services started. So they all look good.
Let's say that that service, for whatever reason, maybe didn't start up or something like that. How could you tell what's running on that server on 443 if you know that that's the target port that should be running?
So my edge service did not start up.
Let's say
any of those services.
Yeah, let's say those services didn't start up.
They failed to start. So why a service failed to start, I would have gone to Event Viewer.
We would have gone ahead and looked through Event Viewer to try and see. So
And see what it complained about. And you're saying it told me I had a conflicted port.
Conflicted port. So how could you on that server go and see what was running, what service is running on that conflicted port? So if you 443 was your conflicted port.
After I'd found my appropriate link server logs and found the nice bloody red stuff and realized it was a port conflict, I could have gone over here to MBT stat and refresh me. It's dash A.
Dash A and O.
And O. Yeah.
A and O.
N O.
It's actually net stat, not NBT stat.
Good call.
So we run netstat dash A and O, and that gives us a list of all the ports. Well, that's a pretty big list. So let's pipe that to the find string. So pipe find space double quotes 443. Okay, so that gives me all the services that are listening on port 443, and I can see the various different ports that it's running on. So I can see right now that we're listening on 210, 211, and 212 on 443, which is actually what I should expect is working. But let's say that the edge service, which should be running on 210, didn't start up and there was some other task using that. So now what do we have? We have task list IDs in that right-hand column. So how would I actually go and trace that task list ID back to what service was actually running?
Yeah, again, I'm a GUI guy, so I would have gone to Task Manager and pulled up the column here on my view.
Pardon? Netstat dash A N O.
Yeah, there's actually another option, right?
Even better.
Call it out. What was it?
B.
B. Boom. Nope.
Nope. Okay. He says remove the find. So that would work too, and then you could have to parse through that list if you wanted to. That's another option.
Probably pipe it to a file and take a look. Sure.
Yeah. So the other, so what we were going to do is we were going to take the process ID, and Aaron actually just went to Task Manager in the GUI, sorted by the process ID, and now you can actually see the name that's there, right? So there are a couple ways that you can do it. You can also run task list SVC in the command line and then pipe for that process ID. Okay? So that was just a little aside. So 443 is up. Do you expect that we should be able to log in now?
I would expect, yep.
Okay.
Let's find out. Or at the least, find the next clue to my problems.
Yes. So I'm going to dance here for about 45 seconds because for some reason in my lab, I have this issue where the login actually takes 45 seconds, and I unfortunately haven't ever been able to figure it out, which is kind of ironic considering that we're doing a troubleshooting lab. But no, it's something to do with the fact that it's in my lab. I think it's actually the licensing check on the client. So when the client first logs in, it actually goes and does the licensing check, and because my clients aren't connected to the internet, that times out and takes some time. But anyways. Pardon? The certificate revocation check, yeah, it's one of the combination of the two of those things. So I just use it as an example to kind of talk. So at this point, let's go back and verify that we can telnet to 443 just to prove that, you know, we didn't have something else in play. Okay, so that's good, right? We couldn't telnet on 443 before. We went, we actually started the service, and now we can go ahead and telnet on 443. So now do we expect that we should be able to see some traffic in our log files? Theoretically, yes. So let's go back and open up that Snooper log file again.
I got something.
Got something. So we're actually doing a register out to the edge server. That's probably not the whole register cycle, though, is it, Aaron?
Doesn't look like it.
No, it does not look like it's the whole register cycle. And again, this is the lovely little idiosyncrasy in my lab that it takes some time. So
we'll keep refreshing here for a moment.
Yeah. So you're just refreshing.
Facts.
You can reload. If you go file reload on the log file. So once you have that log file open, if you just hit file
or
reload
F6.
File or F6.
F6 is a nice trick too.
Yeah. It'll go ahead and reload.
Nothing. Still nothing.
All right, so while that's coming up, what should we see in that register sequence? Should it just, when I go ahead and register the first time, the server just says, yep, come on in, you're registered. Is that the normal register sequence, or should there be sort of a phased register sequence? Pardon? Right, depends if you're doing authentication. So should we always have authentication turned on in Link?
If you're doing TLS, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, even if you're doing TCP based, you still are authenticating. You're just authenticating over an unencrypted channel. Okay, so it signed in. So Link client down on the bottom signed in?
It is, but refresh to not resolve.
Yeah, I find that sometimes you actually need to close it and then reopen it.
That has worked in the past for me.
It has.
That was an interesting demo bug.
Always.
And in case you haven't guessed, this has not been rehearsed demo at all.
Yeah.
So, hey,
okay.
That looks like a good registration.
That looks like it. Okay, so if you open up your Link client upon initial register and you see 401 unauthorized, would that concern you, or is that normal? Why is it normal? What is it? What are we doing when we see that 401 unauthorized? Someone here said normal. Exactly. So if you can't, so for the purpose of the recording, the gentleman in the room said that the initial register says, hey, I'd like to register to you, but I don't really know how to authenticate yet. So please come back and tell me how to authenticate. So Aaron, can you go to that first register line?
You're there.
Oh, that's the one that you're on. So when I first authenticate there, I'm actually sending that's the 401 on author.
Sorry, yeah, this
back,
is the
right?
reply.
Yeah.
There you go.
First
right, register.
So the first register that comes in, actually, no, go to the second one, because that's part of the same sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So that first register that goes in, I have no authentication line that goes with it, right? I basically just say, hey, I want to go ahead and I want to register to you. Okay, and then we get this 401 unauthorized back, and if you zoom in on that, okay, that's telling me that we support which two authentication mechanisms? NTLM and TLS DSK. What is TLS DSK? Certificate authentication, okay? So why am I not seeing Kerberos there? Because it's an external user, okay? So I'm signing in through the edge. The edge is smart enough to know that it's an external user, and we know that you can't get a Kerberos ticket, so we don't even offer Kerberos authentication. So your two choices are NTLM and TLS DSK. So can you go ahead and zoom in on that? So this is the client doing a re-register. What does this tell you? What mechanism has the client chosen to register with here? TLS DSK. What does that tell you? That they had a certificate already. Okay? If they didn't have a certificate, what would you expect to see there? NTLM. And then we would go through the normal NTLM authentication process, sign in with NTLM. If I didn't already have a certificate, and I sign in with NTLM, why don't I just go through and try and sign in with TLS DSK? Timing, okay? So it takes additional time for the client to go and get a certificate to then use that certificate to register, and we don't want to take that time. We want to get the client signed in as quickly as possible. So if we didn't have a certificate, we would go ahead and register using NTLM, and then the client in the background would go out to the web service, get its certificate, and then it would re-register using TLS DSK. And if we had a client that didn't have a cert, you would actually see that process going through.
You'd see two sets of those three lines.
Yeah.
One for the NTLM, and after it got a cert, another reprocess for the certificate auth.
Does it make sense so far? So if you're looking at a log file and you see those 401 unauthorized, you know, don't get concerned. If you see a string of 401 unauthorized and you see that process looping and looping and looping, then that tells you that you have an authentication process problem. But if you just see a couple of 401 unauthorized, just follow them through in logical order and you'll see them. I don't want to spend too much more time here because there are some other things in the lab that we want to get to. But Aaron, can you go to the service message, that first out service message? Okay, so what do you guys think that's asking for? How does the client know how to configure itself? How does it know how to get its contact list? How does it know, where its voicemail URI is? How does it know the dial plan that it should be using? Location profile. Pardon? Sorry? In-band provisioning. Exactly. So this service message is my client basically saying, hey, now that I've registered, I'm kind of dumb. I don't really know anything else about how I should function. So I'm going to send a service request to the server and say, here's who I am. Please give me my application / MS location profile definition in an XML format. Okay? So Aaron, if you zoom out on that, so that service message gets paired with a 200 OK that comes back. How do we know that those two messages are paired together in Snooper? They're color-coded. They're highlighted together. So when Aaron chose the service message on the left-hand side, the 200 OK that comes below got color-coded in a certain way so that he knew that was the paired message to it. So if you're trying to figure out where the 200 OK response is to that service message, you'll see as he's dynamically moving between those items, you see them kind of color-coding themselves. Make sense? All right, so our client signed in, and we wanted to dial 1002, right?
Let's try it.
All right, let's try it.
Hey, look, it's a favorite already. Can I just click that? All right, so 1002. That looks odd to me. Anyone else that look normal or odd? Odd, yes. So not quite the nice, pretty normalized version there, North American style. Apologies for those who aren't.
So where's that number? When you're typing that 1002, is the server normalizing that, or is the client normalizing that?
The client.
The client's normalizing that. And what is the client using to normalize that number?
It's going to be using policies that it got from its in-band provisioning.
Okay. And specifically, what is it? The location profile that it got back?
The part of the voice policies out of the profile, out of the in-band provisioning.
The dial plan, right?
Yes.
The dial plan location profile. Okay, so how could we see in our Snooper trace? Can we see that in our Snooper trace, what those rules are?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go back to our Snooper trace. So again, I'm kind of trying to walk through this with you guys so that we can actually see everything that's occurring is all stuff that if we know where to look in these client-side traces, we actually don't even need to a lot of times go to the server.
No, that's dial location, plan.
Location profile, yeah.
The key there.
Okay, so remember we talked about the service message going out for the location profile and then the 200 OK coming back in?
So this was our out?
Yeah.
This is our back in. There it goes.
And that's back in. So then in Snooper, we've taken that little XML blob that came back and the SDP, the message, and we've kind of expanded it up. So what is the dial plan name or what is the location profile name that this user's been assigned? Link DP. Okay, and how many rules are in it? Two. And what do those rules look like? Let's go ahead and expand them. Zoom in. All right, anybody see our problem? What's our problem? Pardon? It was a first match. So someone went in and created a pattern. So the two, you see the two patterns are the same, but the translations are different. So probably what someone was doing was they had created an additional rule, and maybe they thought that, well, the other one would apply, or well, I don't know what they did, why they did it, but it looks like we have a bad translation pattern in there, right?
Yep.
Okay, so how would we go and fix that bad translation pattern? I mean, obviously we would go back and look through our detailed change log that we keep in our environment and see who had created a change request to create this dial plan rule and submitted it and go back and slap that person upside the head. But we're in, you know, evil administrator land, so evil administrator probably just did it during the middle of the day.
But his boss, I'm sure, blessed it, so.
I'm sure, yeah. So control panel should be open there. It's the fourth icon from the, on the right. Yeah, just flip off. So now, obviously, at this point, there would be multiple ways that we could address this. Either we could, you know, maybe they were really trying to do something there, and we just need to fix the translation pattern, or in this case, Aaron's actually just going to change the order. So,
am I done?
Yeah. Did I do it? I don't know. Are you done?
Not until I commit.
Okay, so we identified a dial plan rule issue within the client. We fixed it in control panel. Before we do anything else at this point, what is one thing that we should do before we go and move anywhere else?
Update change control.
Well, okay, fix that. Yeah, fix our, you know, go back to our change control board and see who's doing what. But that change that gets made into the
topology.
Topology document. Okay, and that topology document needs to do what? Pardon? We don't need to specifically force it to publish, but it does need to replicate. CS management store.
Management, that's right.
And pipe it to FT. If you don't pipe it to FT, you get a whole long laundry list that you have to kind of scroll through. So by piping it to FT, we can see very quickly all the servers in our environment have now picked up those changes. It's not quite enough, right? So when we make a change in the topology document like we just did, we need to make sure that that topology change replicates and that the actual service that is concerned with that change has picked that up. In this case, it's actually just our front-end server sending it down to the client via in-band provisioning, so we don't actually have to wait for a service to pick that change up, but we do need to make sure that it has replicated down to that front-end server. Now, if Aaron were to just go back to his client and try and dial the number again, does anyone think that we've resolved our problem?
Yes, no.
Yes, no? It depends. It depends on how long it took us to do all of that, okay? So the client will periodically resend the service request to the front-end server to say, hey, give me my location profile information, and it will then be returned down to the client. In our special super-duper lab scenario, we probably don't want to wait that long, so I suggest we would just sign out and sign back in, and that would force force the client to pull down the location profile again. Perfect.
All right. Sign in was much faster.
Yeah, like I said, it's kind of a random thing. So we're going to go ahead and dial our number again. Now, does that look better?
It does.
Perfect. All right.
So it's fixed.
It's fixed.
We're good.
Problems, it's all good. Problem's fixed. So let's go ahead and call that number. And remember, that 3CX icon down on the bottom is the one that should be ringing. Okay, so we're connecting. Well, wait, what are we connected to?
Oh, nothing.
That's weird. We weren't connected to that phone, were we?
No.
Unless there was someone else on the other end answering that. They hung up awful fast. Okay, so how would we be able to look at this on the client side again to know, because it looked like something connected and we got connected to something, but then the window closed on us. A handy dandy client log file.
Yep, back to our logs. And we definitely want to go through tracing. No, just kidding. Don't trace for SIP messages. Messages is much better. Okay, so we re-signed in, so we see all this fun stuff again. We still are using our certificate auth, but now we're trying to call a number. So I know the number, so I usually cheat and try to find that number in something relevant. And should I see red since my call failed?
But the call didn't actually fail, right?
Yeah, it didn't.
The call completed. So the call completed, but it didn't complete to the destination that we wanted to complete the call to. So where would we look to see what we actually got connected to? Anyone? Okay, so the suggestion from the back is let's look at the invite and see if we did any manipulation on it. Do you see, can you control one in on that? Doesn't look like it to me. It looks like we sent a SIP invite to +14255551002. So it doesn't look like we did any manipulation on that.
And I got good responses all the way back. So the server knew what to do with the call. So at that point, I'm thinking I would go to the servers to try to find out where my call went. At this point, I'd find out which gateway I was sent to.
Do you think we got to a gateway?
I don't know, but so I'd have to find that out.
Let's look in that buy message. Because we connected to something, right? Zoom in on that with Snooper form, or with Zoom
Snippet.
In? Right there. How do I know what I connected to right there? What am I looking at? User agent. I heard someone say user agent. What user agent am I seeing? Pardon?
Response groups.
Response group service announcement service. That doesn't sound very good, right? That's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to dial out to a PSTN number. What is the response group service announcement service telling me? Pardon? CA? Dial-in conferencing? Is it dial-in conferencing? Anyone? Vacant number range, maybe? So if I've got a PSTN number that my users need to dial out to, can that PSTN number be in my vacant number range and link? No, not good, right? If I have link users configured with a phone number, can their number be in the vacant number range? Yes, because we do reverse number lookup on inbound calls. We do reverse number lookup before we go to the vacant number range. Vacant number ranges, we actually figure out what gateway they're going to after we've checked that vacant number range. Okay, so that call actually got caught by an incorrectly configured vacant number range. And we can see that because we see the user agent string right there as coming back as the response group announcement service. Does it make sense? And again, I'm trying to show you guys all this in just the client side log file. We haven't actually even had to crack open a server side log file. And had we done that, we would have seen SIP messages and S4 SIP stack messages going off to the response group service for the host that happened to be hosting that. So where would we go in?
And if my natural inclination to think, oh, well, it's something between the PBX and the mediation server failed and I jumped to the mediation server, I would have missed it. Never would have got there. And I would have said, well, that's really weird. And I would have had to back up because I didn't look at the information that was available here. So that systematic approach that Scott's been talking about of kind of going through and finding out really where the call ended is with as much detail at the beginning as you can. So.
Okay, so back to our link configuration. And again, we're going to go back to our change record and figure out who created the vacant number range.
I'm sure you keep detailed change logs for your lab, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Let's see, that's a feature.
Voice feature, yeah. Uh-oh. And again, at this point, you've got multiple options. You could either change the range or just go ahead and delete it. It's probably just safe to just go ahead and delete.
Expediency will delete.
Oh, look at that.
commit. Close.
Yeah, go ahead and close that. Good old LinkMX client. And again, this is a topology change. Aaron's going to go ahead and run get CS Management Store replication status to make sure that topology change is replicated out. So when I talked before about making sure that the topology replicates out to each front-end server, we also talked about services needing to make sure that it picks those up, right? So we also need to make sure that our user services service on those front-ends picks up this vacant number range announcement. change, right? Because otherwise, even though it got that information, the service actually has to subscribe to its component of that topology document to figure out that there was some change there. So if you were to look at Event Viewer on that server that you're on right now, and it should be that window open. So there we can see, there we go. So we saw the replicator agent say that the topology had replicated down to the front end, and then the next message that we got from LS outbound routing says vacant number settings loaded successfully. Okay, so that tells me that the change is replicated down and that the service that needs to pick it up has picked it up correctly. I'm gonna give you a little tip. Not every service that was written writes that message to the event log. So if you're looking for those messages all the time, you're not always gonna see them. Unfortunately, not every service is designed the same, but a lot of the services you should see will say, hey, I've now loaded my settings successfully, but again, not every service would do that. So now we're pretty confident that outbound routing has, we fixed that problem and we're past it, so.
So let's try that call again.
No, again, do I need to sign in or sign out of my client at this point? Is any of this problem right now that we just fixed, is any of that client related? No, so I don't need to sign in and sign out of my client. Uh-oh. So different, so it still fails, but it's different.
Failed. Instead of hanging up on me, it failed. So now we get to go back to our logs. Good old 503.
Gateway did not respond in a timely manner. Ouch. That's not good.
I've always wondered what they decided was timely.
So, a couple things. What service sent me this message? Mediation server running on which server? P52L10SE01. Okay? So that tells me that the gateway that P52L10SE01 was trying to communicate did not respond to in a timely manner. We have 8 minutes left, and I want to make sure that we get through these, so I'm going to push this discussion a little bit. Okay, so we would go to that server. We would figure out what gateways that it's connected to. How would we figure that out? Topology, right? So wrong environment.
No badges.
Just go to EE01. Open up the topology document.
Do you have it?
Right here.
There he is.
It is
gateways
in
shared.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and actually reload the topology file, just for fun. So we know we got a message from L10SE01 saying that the gateway is not available. Yeah, just type in any old name in there, it's fine. Okay, so we go down into our Redmond environment, we go to shared components, we go to PSTN gateways, that tells me there's a couple of different gateways there. How would I actually see which server those gateways are connected to? Shown right there on the right-hand side of the screen, okay? So I'm gonna go ahead and I'm gonna look at this and I'm gonna say to you, yep, gateway 10, 10, 152, 21, that doesn't exist, or we've taken that out of the environment. So calls should not be routing to that gateway. Okay? So how would we change that in our link environment?
First we'd come take it out of any call routes.
Okay. Where would we go to make that change?
Sorry. Yep. I'm getting delays. There we go. Nope, it did not refresh. I thought it was there.
No.
There.
There we go. Okay, so we go to routes. And I see that we have a couple of different routes there. How would we actually check our user? Our user is player 4 in this case. How would we check what routes he has access to?
His policies.
His policy? Okay, so can we see from this view what policy that user has?
Nope, we'd have to go to that user, or we could look it back in those log files.
But do we actually, in the client log file, do we actually tell the client what voice routes they have?
Nope. Don't we tell them the policy name, though?
Nope. Ah. The client doesn't care what voice policy it has. The client only cares about its location profile and its dial plan.
Just what's your user
player
name?
Four.
Probably not that many.
Yeah. Search for player four.
Yeah. You do have a lot.
There are a lot of users in this lab. This lab gets used for a lot of stuff. And one of them was testing, creating 10,000 users. So we would have been scrolling for a long time. Okay, so voice policy that's being used is voice policy called what? Link user. And how can I see what routes that are in there very easily on this screen? Click on view. Okay, so that tells me I have a PSDN associated usage called route 425. So now what would I do? I go back to that route. Okay, so he's actually gone into the PSDN usage, and you can see the route, or you can go this way.
And that is my only gateway. Is my other gateway valid?
The other gateway is valid, yeah. So someone's gone in, and they've associated an incorrect gateway to the... Okay, and then go ahead and hit... So again, all from looking at a client log file, right, we were able to see the source of the mediation server tells us what gateway was the gateway timed out. We then went back and said, okay, what routes do I have? I have this route that's using that trunk. That trunk we know is not valid because that gateway doesn't exist. So we've gone ahead and made it a change to the topology again. Okay?
Okay, and we are fresh on our topology.
Yep.
So let's try it.
Okay, so still failed, but is that message different than when we got last time? Yeah. Okay, so again, slightly different message. It says, please check the number and try your call again. This is essentially what it was saying. Let's go ahead and close that and reload it, because for whatever reason right now, the reload function doesn't seem to be working. Two and a half minutes. Come on, we can do it. Okay, 404 not found. Can you zoom in on that? Okay, MS trunking peer. What is that telling me? Have I left link? Does anyone believe that this call left link? Okay, by raise of hands, who thinks the call left link? Should we be raising your hand right now?
A couple of folks scattered around.
Okay, so we got a message back from the user agent snom-pbx, because that's what I'm using for a PBX in my environment. And what is it telling me? User not found. Gateway responded with 404, user not found. So link determined the right gateway to route the call out to and sent the call out, but the gateway responded back and said, nope, sorry, this call wasn't valid. Okay, so what do you think we should do at this point? So if I know that the number, we saw the number normalized correctly, right? Plus 1, 425, 555, 1002. What should I be looking at to see how that number actually got to the gateway? What leg should I be looking at right now? Mediation server to gateway leg, right? And if we had time, not a minute 15, we'd go back and look at that. We turn on logging. Right? But let's go to routing. Okay, so we know that the user dialed the number correctly. We picked the gateway. Once we pick the gateway, what logic does link apply after we pick the gateway? Trunk routing. Right? Okay, so we pick the gateway. We then do trunk routing, and we say any calls that are going out to this gateway, we apply these trunk routing rules. So keep going down. So called number translation rules, looks like we have a bad translation rule there. So we're not sending the full E164 string to that PBX, so the PBX is not responding correctly.
Just removing this one?
Yeah. And I'm sorry, it's a bit of a rush. We kind of killed a little too much time earlier, but I felt that the stuff earlier on was a little more important. So depending on how quickly this topology replicates, we'll actually get to see the call run. Okay, any questions? Does it help? Yeah? Do you guys think you could go back into your labs and do your own breaks and come up with your own sort of creative solutions and uncreative changes and fixes and break them? This is one thing Aaron and I have attended, have been lucky enough to attend the Link master's program several times. And it's actually one of the things that we would do to each other when we're in class is take a working lab environment like this, go in and break certain things, and then have the other person kind of walk through trying to fix them in their environment. So,
we're out of time. If you do have a buddy like that, team up and do it. It helps build your skills, absolutely.
Yeah. Cool. So we'll keep trying. If you guys kind of want to hang around for a couple minutes after and see this call actually go through. Oh, look, there, it's done. Go. Quick, call it. Just
minimize.
To prove that I'm not lying, that it is possible.
Ah, we did it.
You're not fired.
All right.
Okay, so thanks, everyone, for your time. Appreciate you coming out. Fill out your evals, please. Please. I want to know what you like, what you didn't like, and send it in. Thanks.